welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. Today is your first day of Bliss Mind Training. We cover a variety of different topics and subjects on this channel, but oftentimes there are ongoing themes that we come back to from the books that we've learned and the experiences that we've had. One of those key fundamental elements is that the feeling is the secret. There's a realm in which you can exist in permanent bliss that moves beyond the simple idea of reality creation and moves towards your very consciousness and awakens you to the future in which you have no karma and you can move on to greater realms of bliss and ecstasy. There are some amazing spiritual teachers that have discussed this on many different levels. And recently I started really focusing and meditating using Lojong mind training. I had first read about this from Frederick Dodson. In several of his books, he mentions Lojong mind training. And the more I read about it, I traced it back to a book called The Great Path of Awakening, written by Jamgon Kongtrul. This amazing book teaches a unique Buddhist technique using 59 slogans or ideas. In some works, it is referred to as 60 different slogans. But when you meditate on these ideas and you begin to understand how very powerful they are, you can undergo a certain level of mind training which leads you to an amazing level of bliss, joy, and happiness. What does it mean to be in a state of bliss? A word that's used in many spiritual texts. In the Bible, the word joy is used, as I believe that they are synonymous. But I believe once you've reached that state of bliss and you have awakened the light within you, you shine this light on others and awaken their bliss as well. There's a great happiness that results from birth in the higher realms that you could equate to bliss. In the higher realms of gods and men and women who have enlightened themselves of what is referred to as the Shravakas or the Pratyekabuddhas. Enlightenment of these things can be realized. It is not a final nirvana or a transcendence of misery. We should strive for that complete state of perfection spiritually that we can reach within our lifetimes. There's not one specific method to effect this attainment to this higher bliss. There are forms of meditation and ideas which once dwelled upon can lead to a greater state of bliss, or what they called bodhicitta, which is the equivalent of being in a state of a spiritual guru who has reached a state of enlightenment, being in a similar state. So a lot of this training is entering into that highest state of enlightenment, which then, once assumed, outpictures bliss in the whole world around you, and you become like a lighthouse. It's training the mind in love and compassion. As the person who wrote the book, The Great Path of Awakening, said, if the rest of humanity and I wish to attain unsurpassable awakening, the basis for this is bodhicitta, as stable as the king of mountains, compassion which touches everything, and pristine wisdom which does not rely on duality. Once your light is shining, I'm reminded of the story from Frederick Dodson, The Lighthouse in Search of Light. Once upon a time, there was a lighthouse in search of light. With his ray of light, he swept over the lands and waters looking for light, not noticing that he was searching with its light. His beam fell on various objects. Some of the objects reflected the light, and the lighthouse said, "Ah, I found it. This is the light." Still without noticing that he himself was providing the light. After a while, the lighthouse realized the light of the physical objects was not permanently there, that he had not yet found the ultimate source of light. And so he continues this restless search. And then one day he discovers another lighthouse, and the other lighthouse discovers him. And then he was bathed in the light of the other tower. "That is it," he exclaims. "I have never seen that much light." And he fell in love with the other lighthouse, but because he still did not notice that he himself was a source of light, he became dependent on the other lighthouse, dependent on its light. And every time the other lighthouse put its light elsewhere, he missed the warmth and comfort of its light and felt cold and lonely. And one day a wise old sage visited the lighthouse and told him that he is already what he is looking for, that the tool with which he is searching is what he is searching. God cannot be understood because God is what understands, and the eye cannot see itself because it is that which sees, the sage said. Then the lighthouse noticed its own radiant light, and he learned the ability to consciously direct his light and warm others and himself with it. He learned to change the intensity of the radiance according to the situation, and the lighthouse became enlightened, or more precisely, finally noticed that he had been the light all along. I always love that story. So the question is, for your light to shine, it comes from a feeling state that is balanced, that is relaxed, that is blissful and joyful. And when have you been in that happy state? A lot of times, there are things that tie down our own happiness. And that's what Lojong mind training helps us to find that happiness without being attached to something. Inspired by Frederick Dodson, he recommended just going out somewhere without any phone or anything that you have and just sit there for 3 hours. No TV, no computer. I had done this, was sitting by a lake and I had nothing, no phone, no watch. Now, he had recommended 3 hours. I couldn't quite do that, but you start to notice little things. At first, you're bored, and then you're annoyed, and then you're impatient because you have things to do. And then you let that go, and you relax, and you become aware of the moment, and you have suppressed emotions that start to rise up. And you allow these to come up, and you keep sitting with them, and they dissipate, and they take you to a higher level of energy. And then the final hour, you'll begin noticing things in your surrounding you never would have noticed ever. And how beautiful the trees are. And this bliss starts to take over. And you feel this ecstasy without anything, no help from anything. I would say, can you find bliss and ecstasy without the aid of anything? Once you start broadcasting your bliss, the world becomes blissful around you. The people around you are in the same vibration. The houses around you become more beautiful. The plants become more beautiful. The people, everything about it is reflected around you. But it's a hard thing to find because down certain roads, you try to get the bliss that you're looking for and you don't find it because it's already there right now in this moment. If you can feel ecstasy no matter what is happening around you, and especially when nothing is happening, you begin to regain your soul and transcend the constant need for input and events outside of the here and now. You start to bring elation and happiness and joy into your life, bliss, true bliss, instead of expecting to get some sort of bliss out of your life. A body cannot experience itself. Only consciousness can experience things. A mind cannot experience itself. Only consciousness can. There is an aspect of you that is witnessing and is aware of the body and the mind, and that is consciousness. There is a oneness in this consciousness. You don't need to discover the oneness quite yet. That comes way later. But it is an energy. It is something within you. And without consciousness, without this awareness, this I am presence, the body and mind amount to nothing. Your left arm, for instance, does not have the capacity to observe and experience itself. There is something else that is experiencing the arm. And that is consciousness, the real version of you. Mind and body are tools of the consciousness to experience this physical reality that we're in now. Consciousness is the part of you that is unimpressed, undisturbed, and unimprinted by life. Someone could try to indoctrinate you, manipulate you, by imprinting various desires and resistances onto your mind. But throughout it all, the consciousness, this higher presence, remains innocent. Just as Neville Goddard says, we are not the states that we enter into. There is something greater. We love to be around children so much because they are not manipulated, and therefore unmanipulative consciousness shines brightly and innocently. You are manipulated by your environment, the density that you're in, the world, the people. It's a part of the situation. You are being manipulated. The essential aspect of you can never be indoctrinated because it is just an observer, a neutral observer. The mind desires and resists and can easily be programmed by anyone, society, television, all kinds of different programming and suggestions are being used. Consciousness is the context in which the mind and body happen. Consciousness is larger than the mind and body. It is aware of the mind and body because it is closer to the real you. It is worthwhile to study consciousness itself more than studying the mind and body. Consciousness is something that has been taught for thousands of years, and it holds no opinions at all. It is the mind that holds opinions. Your opinions and whether you agree or disagree with something are really not important to your actual experience. If you state your opinions toward another human being, their mind will usually react and state their opinions, which either agree or disagree. One of the narcissistic mind-ego motives is to have superior opinions to that of other mind and ego. When you state your opinions towards consciousness itself, there is no reaction, only observation. Here is an experiment. Go outside and state all of your problems, your complaints, your desires, and opinions toward a tree or toward the stars of the night sky. And how are they going to react? There is no reaction. Opinions and points of view may be important to the world mind and life on earth, but they are not essential to this conscious being within you. Consciousness observes and experiences, but it does not have to retain a file cabinet where these experiences are recorded for later use as an opinion. That means it is able to view things as if it is viewing them for the very first time with no judgment whatsoever. It just knows what something is and what its energy level and purpose is by pure perception, without the need for drawing upon pains and survival needs to form a view of reality. If you closely observe your mind, especially in social situations, you can see its egotistic, narcissistic behavior. It asks itself, is it looking good? It asks if I can come up with a better joke than someone just told. When the group is putting someone down who is not present, it joins in to put that person down even more. However, when it gets criticized, it becomes reactive and defensive, putting others down easily. Having itself be put down is strongly resisted. Becoming aware of what the mind is doing is strongly powerful. It lessens its influence so that more of the witnessing and opening aspects of yourself can shine forth. Now, this consciousness is a part of a larger consciousness. You can call it God, you can call it Source, the Creator, the Infinite, the Ultimate, the Beginning and End, the Most High, the Om, the Presence. There are millions of names for it. Whatever you call it, it is the only real cause. Its presence permeates everything, and it's both my experience and the experience of many others that I've read, that to lead the good life, all you have to do is become aware of this super context, this awareness that is running through you, and you can have all that is good for you in life. You want the good life in every way and every day, then simply always refer to the highest context. Submit your entire life to that which is the most high. In every case of doubt or concern, habitually look first and foremost to the all-pervasive source and consciousness that is present within you to guide you, to support your ideas and resources without exception. When you have a fight with someone, who do you first look? Look to that consciousness, that source. When you have an accident, who do you first look? Seek out this source for inspiration. When you want to get a job, go to this connection that you have of this higher consciousness. Do you realize how good or bad you're doing compared to the lowest ebbs of anguish? You are doing great. Compared to the highest realms of enlightenment, you're doing terrible. So what is better? To compare yourself to the highest states and say, I'm doing terrible, or to compare yourself to the lowest states and say, I'm doing great. There is a state of bliss that you see in common with spiritual gurus, where there's a great amount of compassion that is offered in service. As you raise this level of consciousness, you become more and more compassionate as you touch into the consciousness of all things, and there's this sort of light within you that can resolve it. It's truly transformative and powerful, and if we all had access to it, everything would change. So there's this technique, which in Tibetan Buddhism translates as mind training. It's called Lojong. And Lojong practice consists of 59 slogans, which are organized into 7 points. Most of the 59 slogans don't require explanation or interpretation to a modern context. They are immediately grasped, even though they were written thousands of years ago and based on much older writings. Lojong is an informal discipline, but I do think it's valuable, at least, to be aware of. Some of the slogans are more powerful than others. Be aware that following these 59 slogans can lead you into a state of bliss, enlightenment, awareness, a releasing of the ego, the limitations of where you're at right now. So the first one is to train in the preliminaries. In our day-to-day life, our mind tends to follow a certain exhausting track. We're constantly engaged in thoughts which shape our feelings and attitudes, and these thoughts are usually based on sensory perceptions. We see or hear something and think that it's beautiful or ugly, pleasant or unpleasant. If it's pleasant, we mentally grasp after it. If it's unpleasant, we mentally reject it. If neither, our mental state becomes dull in relation to the object. When we wander off into the past, we occupy ourselves with memories of pleasantness and unpleasantness, and we continue to grasp and reject. First, train in the preliminaries. This encourages us to make time in our lives to shape our mind intentionally, rather than staying in this rut. taking some time every day, even as little as 5 minutes for some contemplation, will help us to use our mind to its best capacity and to develop clarity and perspective about our lives. Jamgon Kongtrul organizes this preliminary contemplation into four parts. First, the difficulty of attaining the freedoms and endowments. Secondly, death and impermanence. Third, the defects of the life cycle or samsara. And four, contemplating the result and cause of karma. Now, the difficulty of attaining the freedoms and endowments means contemplating the preciousness of our life, the very situation we have right now. All sentient beings feel their lives are precious, but here we are talking about something more. We have the rare and incredible fortune to have this reality in our lives. More specifically, we have teachings that lead us away from our habitual self-importance and in the direction of a much more beneficial and fulfilling altruism. Imagine you find yourself in the middle of the Sahara Desert in an infinite vastness of sand. You can't just hang out there. The sun is too hot. There's no food or water. You have no idea which way to go. You have no reference point. In every direction, all you can see is sand and more sand. Nevertheless, you feel compelled to walk. What else can you do? But the more you walk, the more sand you see. There's no sign of anything but desert, and therefore no hope of any positive outcome. Eventually, you'll just drop dead, having accomplished nothing. Now imagine that you may miraculously discover a map which shows you exactly where you are, why you have been going around aimlessly, and in which direction you need to travel. You find that food and water and shelter are not hopelessly far away. You have a clear path to survival. Revived by this discovery, you set out in the right direction and become free from your awful predicament. In this analogy, the Sahara represents our habitual self-importance, which is so all-encompassing that it seems to have no beginning and no end. The map, which leads us in the direction of altruism or service, represents bodhicitta, a Sanskrit word that can be translated as the mindset of awakening. The mindset of awakening is a state of mind of the bodhisattvas, which are those who attain and strive for enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, meaning that they're not just striving for enlightenment, but seeking out enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, devoting themselves without limit or hesitation to fulfilling this aim. And as we will see throughout this episode, this extraordinary mindset is really what we're aiming to develop when we do these practices to create this state of bliss. We all long to be happy and free from suffering. But without awakening, we have no orientation toward that happiness and freedom. The attitude of awakening and the practices that help promote it give us a way of dealing with our present suffering and of eventually transcending suffering altogether forever. Now, they use the word suffering a lot in Buddhist teachings and practices, and it always annoyed me. To me, suffering is when you miss the mark, and with your mind, you create realities that you did not intend to create. That's, to me, the suffering they're talking about, and you can overcome this suffering by changing your way of thinking. So, I don't think we're all doomed to suffering, but when we look outward and we see all the other beings suffering, and they want to be happy as much as we all do, then our care for our small individual self transforms into a care for a much bigger self. When you start to see yourself in others, and you're tuned into this consciousness that is both in me and you, we begin to grow from having just care of our own self to a universal care. And right away, our own suffering and unhappiness becomes much smaller and insignificant. It does not instantly and totally disappear, but there's a shift. It diminishes naturally and progressively as we free ourselves from worrying about the self and we move on to serving others. When the sun shines, it absorbs all the light of the moon and stars into its brightness. Similarly, when we awaken in this manner, the brilliant light of our universal love and care outshines and absorbs our concerns for this one individual. Instead of dropping dead in the Sahara from thirst, we can travel purposefully and confidently along the path that is on the map until we reach its culmination, which is the complete and irreversible awakening to our own true nature, which they like to call enlightenment. But it's a state of awakening. And since our true nature is identical to that of the Buddha and of Jesus and all other awakened gurus, when we awaken to it, we will be free from all illusions and enjoy limitless wisdom, love, and power to benefit others, having the opportunity to start to realize our potential in such a magnificent way is why our life is so precious now. Once we've inspired ourselves by thinking about our precious opportunity, being grateful in the moment for the things we have, we should move on to the second contemplation of the four, and that's death and impermanence. If we want to make the best of our life by developing our bodhicitta, our awakening, we can't keep putting it off. We will not be in this world much longer. Even if you're very young and have as many as 80 more years still to live, 80 years isn't much. We can think about great beings from the past, kings and queens and other grand figures who are so important and full of life. Now they're all gone. There's no one here from the century before last, let alone those distant ages. Perhaps technology will change and we'll be able to live longer. And that's what I imagine for my future. Even the enlightened ones from the past who achieved mastery over their physical ailments and were able to perform miracles have gone from this world. So while we are here for this short time, what is the point of doing anything but dedicating ourselves to this awakening, to stepping out of the small self and embracing the universal self? Some of our daily activities are necessary to sustain us, but trying to secure ourselves as if we're going to live forever is foolish. No one has ever been able to secure anything. Why would we be different? Look at how the four seasons change. Can we secure one season and prevent it from transitioning to the next? Contemplating impermanence helps us have a simpler approach to life in which we no longer create kingdoms in our minds. When we die, we won't be able to take anything with us, not even our own body, but we take our minds, we take our energies, and those move on. But the body's not important. We are not our body. The third subject to contemplate when training in the preliminaries of this first slogan is the defects of samsara. The Sanskrit word samsara refers to the perpetual cycle of suffering that we sentient beings go through as a result of our innocent but ignorant self-importance. This cycle will never come to an end unless the rascal in our heart is recognized for what it is and banished forever. We human beings are very resilient. However much we suffer, when the pain is over, we tend to move on and forget. In a way, that is admirable, but if there's something we can actually do about our suffering, if we can eliminate negative consequences, if we can eliminate the causes and thus become free, if peace and happiness are realistic possibilities, then does it make sense to keep on living in reality we don't want to live in? When we have some understanding of the causes of moving into these realities, but insist on bearing it over and over again, never learning our lesson, would you say that such resilience is intelligent? The countless ways we can suffer can be put into three categories: physical, emotional, and mental. Physical suffering is probably the easiest to deal with, but they all can affect us. When we have mental suffering, the pain of our conceptual mind, there is the suffering of ignorance, which comes in two forms. First, we don't know what's going on in our mental process, what is arising in the moment by moment. We're not aware of it. The second is we're ignorant that even if we have a glimpse of what's going on, we have no idea what to do about it. Not knowing what's happening and not knowing what to do are painful. Emotional pain is different because it's harder to understand. Our emotional world is murky. We feel vaguely insecure. So the point is to step out of our small singular self and embrace the limitless universal self of all sentient beings. We generate this awakening and practice the exchange of self and other self. In this life and in infinite past lives, we've tried every conceivable method. Awakening is the only thing we haven't tried. And awakening to other selves happens to be the best method to do this work. The second slogan is to consider all phenomenon as a dream. Thousands of years ago, they were saying to consider reality as a dream. That's the slogan. Everything is an illusion or a simulation. And when you're in a dream, how does it relate to our waking experience? When we're asleep, our dreams affect us and convince us of their reality because we don't realize we are just dreaming. Isn't that what's happening when we're awake if we take this slogan? The third is, examine the nature of unborn awareness. I think the best idea is to turn our attention inward and look at our minds. See whether it has any form, shape, color, or anything. Is there anything we can put a finger on and say, this is my mind, or this is my awareness? Does it have a place of origin? Is there a location? When each mental experience ends, does it go to a particular place? We can look, but we'll never find answers to any of those questions. Then we start to see ourselves, what other great meditators have discovered. Not finding anything is finding. Why can't we find these characteristics? Because our mind is like space. It is everywhere. It is primordial. There's never a time before space came into being. Therefore, we can say that space is unborn in the same way our mind, our awareness, is primordial. Because we can never find our awareness. We can never say that we are ever a time when our awareness didn't exist and was then born. Now, fourth, the antidote in itself is liberated. When we gain this basic understanding, the mind is unborn, that it has no characteristics, that it's empty, an interesting thing happens because we have discovered something important, remarkable, and in line with the most profound teaching. We want to hold on to this realization. We know that our mind and all phenomena are illusory, and we want to maintain that knowledge. Seeing, for example, that our painful emotions are unreal is the most powerful antidote to suffering. So having this incentive, we tend to cling to our view of emptiness in subtle ways. When we have a glimpse of emptiness, we try to hold on to it and make that experience continue. We may even try to create some kind of emptiness in our minds. Of course, it is not actual emptiness, but our idea of it. At that point, we need to take a step back and look at this clinging to our idea of emptiness. What is that experience? Is there anything we can really find or pinpoint? Does that experience cling? No matter how hard you look at it, you won't be able to find any kind of reality to this grasping mind. The fifth is to rest in the nature of the alaya. Through this investigation, our idea of emptiness will eventually fade away and we'll be left simply with our unborn, wakeful state of mind, free from all of our usual grasping to concepts. It is a state of mind there is no language for, since language is based on concept. In this state, our mind is free from all pinpointing and clinging to reality. Since our mind grasps at nothing, any thoughts that arise are instantly self-liberated. They simply melt into space. This space, which is not a void but is pervaded by enlightened awareness, is called alaya. So rest in the nature of the alaya. The word alaya has different definitions based on context. It often refers to an underlying dullness in our mind that is the source of our deluded experience. In this slogan, however, alaya refers to the enlightened nature that all beings with a mind possess. The spiritual guru's ultimate aim is to realize this state of alaya and bring all other beings to that same realization. Now, as I said before, many of these slogans do not require explanation or detail. For example, the sixth in post-meditation, be a child of illusion. Seventh, practice giving and taking alternately. Mount both on your breath. The more I read about this, the more this reminded me of the balancing technique as taught by Ra in the Law of One Material. That is, you bring in the negativity and you transform it with a feeling of joy. You meditate that each individual receives all the happiness and cultivate a strong feeling of joy in each one's receiving this joy. You make this exchange. It's something they refer to as Tonglen, the exchange of self and other. Exchanging your affection for intolerance, exchange of positions, exchange of happiness for suffering, exchange of merit for demerit. Those are the four things that they talk about in Tonglen. I really think the idea is to contemplate our essential equality with all other beings, our oneness with them, develop a bond with them in our minds, connect with them, imagine for them. The next slogan, number eight, is three objects, three poisons, three roots of virtue. The three objects are friends, enemies, and neutrals. The three poisons are craving, aversion, and indifference. And the three roots of virtue are the remedies. I contemplated on this for a while. In order to step out of our small self and develop our altruistic, service-oriented mind, we need to take every opportunity we have to research the qualities of those that have come before us, that have entered into that state of bodhisattva, or that higher enlightened state, especially compassion. Fortunately, our whole life is like a research laboratory, and in this lab, there are continual tests, and we ourselves are the perfect research subjects. We are the perfect guinea pigs. In order to feel compassion, we have to know how others suffer, how they feel. The only way to learn how others feel is to learn how we ourselves feel. So in that way, we can be like guinea pigs for how the world and the sentient beings feel. There is no way to get this knowledge. You can't go into your mind and experience your own feeling directly. You can only know your feeling through inference. And the only reason my inference about another human being suffering or feeling can be accurate is because I am a human being. When I see my own confusions, my own shortcomings, my own attachments and aggressions, my own random disconnect, incoherent, almost schizophrenic mind, what am I seeing? I'm seeing myself as a guinea pig of sentient beings' mind, a guinea pig of beings' ignorance. If you see your own mind in this way and don't have compassion for yourself, how can you have compassion for others? If you judge yourself as responsible for your ignorance and therefore guilty and deserving punishment, you'll probably see others in the same way. Why would you judge others less harshly than yourself? Do you love them more? Are you more tolerant and forgiving of others? That's probably not true. So it's important for us to learn compassion for ourselves and for our own confused but innocent mind. When we look in the mirror, we see how we create our own turmoil, our own reality, by clinging so hard to this small self, even though it has enslaved us mercilessly through life after life. We can turn that mirror into a window for seeing how others are suffering. Seeing the bigger picture in this way makes it much easier to generate compassion. Your ongoing disturbing emotions are like a train you want to stop, but the train has been going for too long. It's going too fast, and you, the conductor, are just an infant. In this almost impossible situation, you can spin around with thoughts of what to do, or you can use the power of the emotions themselves and get situated in the heart of compassion for all who are suffering, for all who are making mistakes that are creating terrible realities. You can practice the exchange of self and other. Think about all those who are going through the same pain as you. Take the cargo of their suffering and load it onto your own boxcar and make a sincere, heartfelt wish that they won't have to suffer anymore because of You're taking on their load and see it transformed in your light. This does something wonderful. The trains of our confusion and painful emotions right now sometimes seem like they're going very fast. The modern world is hectic, stimulating lifestyle. It has picked up tremendous speed. Everything seems to be moving faster, but even if a train is going a million miles per hour, if you load it with the weight of all the being suffering, it will stop in an instant. You don't have to push or pull. You don't have to find a more experienced conductor. You don't have to struggle in any way. With such a load, the train will stop naturally by the laws of physics. All you have to do is get out of your head, situate yourself fully in the heart, and add the suffering of others to your own. If we really get to know others' afflicted minds by seeing our own, it becomes natural, even joyful, to take on their sufferings in this way and imagine for them differently. Genuine compassion naturally comes with fearlessness. If one person can take care of the needs of many, say a whole family or community, that is a cause of joy. The slogan refers to three objects, three poisons, and three roots of virtue. Throughout our lives, we continually encounter objects that we find pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Pleasant objects provoke some degree of attachment in our minds. It could be powerful or subtle, but by any form of attachment disturbs our mind. Wanting to bring something into our lives or wanting to keep something we already have are emotions based on the small self. Unpleasant objects provoke some degree of aversion or aggression that is unsettling. And our reaction to neutral objects, the ones we don't really notice or those we feel indifferent toward, is related to our ignorance. Attachment, aggression, and stupidity are called the three poisons because they are the main manifestations of cherishing and protecting the small self. They're like the primary colors of all of our emotions. The way to transform these objects and poisons into roots of virtue is by taking on the suffering of others to be of service to others, loading it into our light and transforming it. For example, when we're disturbed by aggression, we can think, at this very moment, my light is transforming those beings from feeling pain into feeling love. The ninth slogan, in all conduct, train with maxims. In his commentary, the writer says and gives some examples, when all the suffering and evil deeds of every sentient being mature in me, may all my virtue and happiness bear fruit in them. In one way or another, all the various slogans and quotations found in this that we're talking about express the mindset of compassion and connecting to others. One of the special maxims of these is, I offer all gain and victory to others. Each and every sentient being, I accept all loss and defeat for myself. Because I am aware of the power that I have to transform it. I take it all in and transform it all. Slogan 10, begin the sequence of sending and taking with yourself. That means take in all that stuff that's been happening to you, that negativity, that suffering, those realities that you don't want to create. Take it into you. Allow the emotion to come up for it. Transform it with your light. Resolving all that karma from the past and the future. Bring it all in. Begin the sequence of the taking on this self with yourself. The 11th slogan, when the world is full of evil, transform misfortune into the path of awakening. This is why I like to say everything is working to my advantage. When I encounter difficulties, when I encounter obstacles and problems and the world is full of evil, I take that in and I assume that everything is working to my advantage and to the world's advantage, and that from it we can transform. That this can be the path in which we gain a transformation from the evil that we are encountering. That everything is working to our advantage. The 12th is, realize all faults spring from one source. This is undeniably recognizing that all comes from consciousness, that one source, that one thought, that all is one. That it is not the small self, that it is in the oneness, in the allness, that there is the source. The 13th is to meditate upon gratitude toward all. Just meditate on unconditional gratitude for all. It allows you to look at all things. It addresses the mirror image of the previous one, the one source that we see. The 14th slogan is to meditate upon illusory appearance as the four kayas. This is the unsurpassable protection of emptiness. The kayas are Dharmakaya, Sambhokaya, Nirmanakaya, and Svabhavakaya. Thoughts have no birthplace. Thoughts are unceasing. Thoughts are not solid. And these are the three characteristics are interconnected. Shunyata can be described as complete oneness. Teaching on the four kayas would be a whole other episode, but we must understand that all of our experience we go through are dreamlike delusions. Yourself and the threats you perceive, such as illness and their so-called causes, are nothing but thoughts. If we try to pinpoint our thoughts or find any characteristics in them, we can't find anything. Our thoughts are empty of any reality. Understanding this illusory aspect of reality is helpful in training the mind. Our minds are so habituated to viewing all appearances as real, therefore, we should always work with these sort of methods and include it as a slogan. The 15th is the four practices are the best methods. The four practices are accumulating merit, laying down evil deeds, offering to the dons, and offering to the Dharma pious. Accumulating merit is as simple as just doing the right thing on a regular basis. And laying down evil deeds just means stopping missing the mark, stopping making mistakes, doing the morally right thing, following the golden rule. The other two are interesting. You have the special practice of offering tormas to gods and demons. Tormas are a kind of offering cake, which in Tibet are usually made from barley flour. In the West, we can offer cookies. In his commentary, Jamgon Kongtrul says little about the tormas themselves, instead emphasizing the attitude behind this offering, especially when offering to the demons, who can be seen as anyone, visible or not, who bring us trouble. He encourages us to have the fearless attitude of asking the demons to bring us even more trouble so that we can repay all our karmic debts and destroy our habit of clinging to a small self. On top of that, we ask for the sufferings of all beings to pile upon ourselves so that they may all be free. This is much like what Jesus did on the cross. Jesus shows what it means to take the spirit of Tonglen to the highest level. Finally, there's the special practice of offering tormas to the Dakinis and protectors. These are powerful beings who have committed themselves to help sincere practitioners attain enlightenment, higher density beings. Then we have the 16th, which is use whatever you face as a practice immediately. To me, that relates to the teaching from Ra that everything that we encounter in our lives is catalyst. And we can learn this to teach us as practice whatever we're encountering to transform from negativity into light. The 17th is to practice the five strengths. The first is strong determination or motivation. The second is familiarization. The third is the positive seed. The fourth is reproach. And the fifth is aspiration. The 18th, the Mahayana instruction for ejection of consciousness at death, is the five strengths. How you conduct yourself is important. When you're dying, the practice of the five strengths. The next slogans can be broken up into evaluation of mind training, the disciplines of mind training, and the guidelines of mind training. Slogan 19 is that all Dharma or reality agrees at one point. All teachings are about lessening the ego, lessening one's self-absorption. The 20th, of the two witnesses, hold the principle one. You know yourself better than anyone else knows you. Slogan 21, always maintain only a joyful mind. Slogan 22, if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained. The 23rd, always abide by the three basic principles: dedication to your practice, refraining from outrageous conduct, developing patience. The 24th is to change your attitude, but remain natural. Reduce ego clinging, but be yourself. 25th, don't talk about injured limbs. Don't take pleasure contemplating other defects. 26 is don't ponder others. Don't take pleasure contemplating others' weaknesses. 27th, work with the greatest defilements first. Work with your greatest obstacle first. The 28th is abandon any hope of fruition. Don't get caught up in how you will be in the future. Stay in the present moment. 29th, abandon poisonous food. The 30th, don't be so predictable. Don't hold grudges. The 31st, don't malign others. 32, don't wait in ambush. Don't wait for others' weaknesses to show to attack them. 33rd, don't bring others to a painful point. Don't humiliate others. The 34th, don't transfer the ox's load to the cow. Take responsibility for yourself. The 35th, don't try to be the fastest. Don't compete with others. 36, don't act with a twist. Do good deeds without scheming about benefiting yourself. The 37th, don't turn gods into demons. Don't use these slogans or your spirituality to increase your self-absorption. 38th, don't seek others' pain as the limbs of your own happiness. The next ones being the guidelines of mind trading, the 39th, all activities should be done with one intention. 40, correct all wrongs with one intention. 41, two activities, one at the beginning, one at the end. 42, whichever of the two occurs, be patient. 43, observe these two even at the risk of your life. 44, train in the three difficulties. 45, take on the three principal causes, the teacher, the Dharma, the Sangha. 46, pay heed that the three never wane, gratitude towards one's teacher, appreciation of the Dharma, and correct conduct. 47, keep the three inseparable body, speech, and mind. 48, train without bias in all areas. It is crucial always to do this pervasively and wholeheartedly. 49th, always meditate on whatever provokes resentment. 50, don't be swayed by external circumstances. 51, practice the main points before self, Dharma, and awakening compassion. 52, don't misinterpret. The six things that may be misinterpreted are patience, yearning, excitement, compassion, priorities, and joy. You're patient when you're getting your way, but not when it's difficult. You yearn for worldly things instead of an open heart and mind. You get excited about wealth and entertainment instead of your potential for enlightenment. You have compassion for those you like, but none for those you don't. Worldly gain is your priority rather than cultivating loving kindness and compassion. You feel joy when your enemies suffer and do not rejoice in others' good fortune. The 53rd is don't vacillate in your practices of mind training. The 54th, train wholeheartedly. 55, liberate yourself by examining and analyzing, knowing your own mind with honesty and fearlessness. The 56th, don't wallow in self-pity. The 57th, don't be jealous. 58th, don't be frivolous. And 59th, don't expect applause. I could go over each of these slogans in detail, creating an entire episode, and maybe I will. Don't expect applause. Don't expect that others are going to applaud you for your efforts in service. Don't be frivolous. No need for you to be jealous of others. There's no need for you to pity yourself. Don't examine yourself. Liberate yourself from that. Don't overanalyze yourself. Train wholeheartedly with all your heart. Don't be swayed by what's happening in the outside world. I was quite interested in number 37. Don't turn gods into demons. Don't use these slogans or your spirituality to increase your self-absorption. Don't get so far into yourself with these trainings. Now that may be a lot to take on. Those are 59 basic concepts to ponder on, to meditate on, to think about. It's not complicated, but the core of this is compassion and entering into a state where you can look at another and be aware of what's going on for them. Moving outside of yourself into the loving, unconditional heart. And when you do this, there's great joy that can happen. The first steps is to start with the basics. Learn about yourself. Learn to love yourself. Learn to take what you have done in your life and transform it with the love in your life. Accept the joy and peace in your life, as I gave the story at the beginning. Learn to find bliss and ecstasy and happiness and joy without anything attached to it. You can be happy in any situation, no matter what. When you find this pure state, when you become that lighthouse that shines your light that you've always been shining, then you know how to direct that light. And when you find that place in the beginning, then you can take on all of the problems of the world and you can transform it with your light, because your light transforms when you're in this state of bliss, when you have connected to the others, when you've entered into this higher energetic vibration of compassion and oneness with others. When someone else is suffering, you feel that suffering for yourself. We are the brothers and sisters of sorrow. We are attracted to this sorrow like moths to the flame. Deep down, there's a part of you that is now awakening. And you become aware that you are the light that can transform this world. Don't be afraid and resist the many problems in the world. Just see your light transforming it. Transmute the chaos. You can do this now with your mind training. And you'll enter into a constant state of bliss because you'll feel genuine joy for others, which will be reflected in yourself. It's an ongoing, beautiful feedback loop of bliss, joy, and happiness that is available to you. I recommend that you go and read the book, The Great Path of Awakening by Jamgon Kong Trul. I think it's a good place to start for this particular Lojong mind training. And you don't necessarily have to follow these sequences. It's just a good place to start. What he did is he looked at other spiritual teachers and what they were doing, and he found these particular points to follow. And I certainly could get into each of those, but it should awaken your mind to the fact that if you move beyond yourself. Recently had an amazing interview with Lynn McTaggart, and she identified scientifically the power of altruism to put us in a state of coherence, that altruism can be very beneficial to our lives. When we start to think outside of ourselves, our own intentions become more effective. This is the great path of mind training. In order to truly manifest with intensity and power and effectiveness, you have to move beyond the little self and manifest from the larger self. And this is a simple guide in order for you to do that. It doesn't require you to understand anything. These are basic concepts, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel when you meditate on these concepts. If any of them don't resonate with you, forget about it. It's the concept behind it that is powerful. So definitely check that out. You can find all episodes of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.